This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's day 18 of a partial government shutdown with no end in sight. President Trump delivers a primetime address from the Oval Office tonight. He isn't budging from his demand for $5 billion for a border wall. Democrats say they won't fund Trump's signature campaign promise. Meanwhile, more than 800,000 federal workers aren't being paid, and thousands of third-party contractors, like janitors and security guards, may never be paid at all for the time missed. Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley is introducing legislation today that would ensure contractors collect back pay whenever the shutdown finally does end. In fact, she just gave a speech about it on the House floor.
I rise today on behalf of the families concerned about feeding their children because their WIC benefits will run dry. I rise today in solidarity with the thousands of workers with calloused hands and broken spirits working for no pay.
Congresswoman Pressley joins us now from Washington. Congresswoman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's good to be with you.
There is so much to talk about, the shutdown, the president's speech tonight, the legislation you just introduced today. But first, let's just step back for a moment. This is your first full week in Congress. You were just sworn in last Thursday. You spent the morning at a ceremony for the Congressional Black Caucus. Let's listen to a bit of that right now.
Representative Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts.
Must feel good, Congresswoman. And you ran saying the change can't wait. The wait is over for you. So what does it feel like to finally be there in Washington?
I'm ready to get to work. It feels, again, I feel grateful to represent the Massachusetts 7th. I'm proud of what we accomplished in the election to make it possible for me to be here, to work in partnership to effectuate change for the Massachusetts 7th. As I've said repeatedly, I really have not allowed myself much space to be joyful and jubilant because I feel a tremendous sense of responsibility given the time that we find ourselves in as a country, this crossroads, which was true when I was running and is even truer today. So I am glad to be at work and doing the thing that I was most passionate about, and that is legislating. To mitigate the hurt in people's lives and to uplift and to advance the residents of the Massachusetts 7th. And so I'm doing that in the midst of this government shutdown in partnership with the great Eleanor Holmes Norton and also the union members of 32BJ and others, specifically to lift up the fact that although the 800,000 furloughed employees when the government does return to business and the shutdown ends, they will receive retroactive pay. But this is not true for the federally contracted workers, such as the food service workers, janitorial staff, and the like. And so this is an issue of consequence to thousands of workers throughout the country. And Massachusetts 7th is certainly not exempt.
NPR estimated this morning that there are more than 4 million contractors going without pay. So, Congresswoman, are you trying to cover all of them with this bill, or are you particularly targeting the blue-collar workers you were just describing?
I'm focused on the low-wage hourly workers. And so, what I did earlier this week is to send a letter to leadership urging Democratic leadership to make this a part of our negotiations.
So the other big news of the day is this speech the president will deliver from the Oval Office tonight. We can anticipate that he will drum up a lot of anger, as he calls, describes as crisis, as he's called it, on the U.S.-Mexico border. What are the prospects, in your view, Congresswoman, of a compromise between the president's position, he wants that wall, versus Democrats saying, we don't want to give it to you?
No wall. It is unconscionable that a compromise would even be considered that would lead to the construction of such a wall. He has manufactured another crisis, a tsunami of hurt for the American people, and he has couched his rationale in complete falsehoods. Our border is secure. There is no crisis at the border. We are not fearful of families seeking asylum at the border, women and children. What we need is compassionate, comprehensive immigration reform. The immigration crisis is that we don't have compassionate, comprehensive immigration reform. And we have people that are staying beyond their visas because there is no pathway for them. The crisis is not at the border. This is about a larger, more systemic policy change that needs to occur, and a wall will not fix that. So this is a big Trojan horse, and meanwhile, American people are hurting. And as I referenced on the floor in my first one-minute speech, this is everyone from survivors of domestic abuse who are fleeing the hands of their abusers and could stand to show up at shelters and find those doors locked because of this shutdown. This is for families who need WIC benefits to feed their children, and these benefits may very soon run dry. This is for the hourly low-wage worker, food service, janitorial, who has no assurances that even if we come out of a shutdown, that they will be able to pay their bills and to provide for their family. You know, 5 days ago, I took an oath to protect and to defend the Constitution and the American people from all threats, domestic and foreign. And I do believe that the current occupant of the White House is a threat to both of those.
But is there no deal, nothing he could offer that would let you say, you know what, just throw him a bone, just give him his $5 million for the wall? I mean, suppose he were to say, I'd be willing to give you a path to citizenship for dreamers.
I'm not going, let me just say something. I don't make any decision about a vote I will cast or legislation I will author without being in consultation and working cooperatively with those who have been leading on the front lines and who stand to be most impacted by an issue. The families of dreamers have told me, do not negotiate and bargain with the lives of our children.
Let's move on to another.
Because the other issue here is that we could be using $5 billion to fund universal child care. We could be using $5 billion. I mean, here's the real rib here is ironic is that he continues to couch this in the fake news narrative of border security when our borders are secure, but he's actually greater compromising our security because we need an investment in customs officers and we need other investments that would get at these broader goals around immigration to stem the scourge of drug trafficking, of human trafficking, of gun trafficking, all of these things. So it would take away resources that would really go a long way in keeping the border secure.
Congresswoman, I do want to ask you about one of your other legislative priorities that you announced shortly after your swearing in, which is you're co-sponsoring a legislation to repeal the Pay-As-You-Go Act, or PAYGO for shorthand. This is the law that until this week may have been kind of obscured to a lot of folks, but it's significant in the way the Congress conducts its business. And it basically means that any new spending must be offset by an equal spending cut or a tax increase. Why do you take issue with that principle?
I really do think that this is the strategic solution by getting at the statute that will allow us to address, you know, the underlying issues, which are why I ran.
But is the main problem the policy of it or the politics? Like, is it that PAYGO is just a bad system, or is it that, you know, Democrats would be unilaterally disarming if they were to adhere to the principle because the Republicans, after all, in 2017, just recently disregarded it when they passed a $1.5 trillion tax cut?
Again, the root of the problem is the policy. It is the law. It is the statute. We need to do away with that so that we are there is no obstruction to our advancing a progressive agenda, especially when we have been emboldened coming in under a Democratic majority. And so many of the majority makers in red to blue states or in more progressive districts ran on everything from a Green New Deal to Medicare for All, and we don't want anything to be an obstruction to these more aspirational goals, which the American people are actually demanding. I saw some chatter on social media earlier today where this proposal and others were being wrapped up in as something radical. But truth be told, these are not fringe pushes. These are not extreme leftist pushes. this is what most Americans want.
You know, one of the things you ran on, of course, was reducing the impact of big money in politics. In fact, you rejected corporate PAC money in your own race. You've said you plan to lead campaign finance reform efforts in Congress. What exactly are you proposing?
I'm sorry?
Campaign finance reforms. What exactly do you have in mind?
Is it a ban on super PACs?
What are the particulars?
Sure. Well, it's not just me. So I'm very proud that the first bill that we moved forward as Democrats, H.R. 1, struck right at the heart of two issues that I think are critical to restoring the American people's faith in our democracy, and that is voting rights, campaign finance reform, and ethics reform. And then personally, you know, I will continue to reject corporate PAC money, the influence of dark money. These issues are of consequence to the Massachusetts 7th, the opioid crisis, gun violence, environmental injustices. And for the sake of our planet, for the sake of public health and public safety, I simply cannot accept those funds.
Should all Democrats do the same, including in the 2020 presidential race? Because I'm reminded that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton said that they opposed super PACs, for example, but they also used them. And the argument was basically, you know, you got to play under the rules as they are. Otherwise, you're giving Republicans a huge competitive advantage.
Well, I won't. I'll save my lobbying for outside of this radio interview with any of my colleagues. But I respect, you know, how every one of my colleagues arrives at their own personal choices and decisions. I do think that we're all on the same page in terms of legislative fixes to address corruption. We're anti-corruption and undue influence. And I'm proud to be a co-sponsor of H.R. 1 for that reason.
You and your fellow freshmen are also awaiting your committee assignments coming any day now. Is that right?
Yes, anxiously awaiting. And I have been making the rounds and lobbying and hopefully making the case in order to best meet the needs of the Massachusetts 7th and to address the entrenched systemic inequities and disparities that the district will be well served by my appointment to the Financial Services Committee. It would allow me to address not only consumer protection, to keep Ben Carson in my sight line, to address everything from public housing to the affordable housing crisis, but also to address redlining, underbanking, and so many other issues that I think also wealth and the wealth gap, specifically along racial lines. So I hope to be appointed to the Financial Services Committee. With its new chairwoman, Congresswoman Maxine Waters. I've also hoping to be considered for the Education and Labor Committee, which, again, are two chief ways to get to systemic inequities and disparities in the Massachusetts 7th. And that would allow me to keep Betsy DeVos in my sight line. And so, you know, I think it would... I think my constituents would be pleased to know that I would wake up with those two priorities every day.
You've also said you'd be interested in serving on the Judiciary Committee, and that's, of course, where impeachment proceedings would begin. You told the Bay State Banner in the fall, quote, "I plan on working actively to see Donald Trump impeached." So what's the status of that effort, and what are the president's impeachable offenses in your view?
Yeah, well, let me just say this. You know, first and foremost, impeachment has always been on the table. And what I said is that if I were appointed to judiciary, it would give me a front row seat. I think at this time it's less an issue of if the president will be impeached and perhaps more when. But it's always been on the table. We're waiting the Mueller report. But this is not what I'm leaning in on right now. What we need to do is to get this government out of shutdown, get government working again for the American people, for real people, on those issues that are of consequence to them. This is why, as proud as I am to have supported H.R. 1 and to be a co-sponsor, both to tackle corruption and to strengthen voting rights and all the things critical to restoring the American people's faith in democracy, it also was not lost on me that our closing arguments to the American people were on issues of consequence like health care and infrastructure, issues that every day they are impacted by. And that's why I pushed for an expedited gun bill in my very early conversations with leadership and with the Congressional Progressive Caucus and with the Democratic Caucus, that we move quickly on a gun bill. And so I'm encouraged to see that happening today. Gun violence is a public health crisis and epidemic. It is certainly an issue that disproportionately impacts the Massachusetts 7th. I'm proud to sign on as an early co-sponsor of that gun bill. I'm looking right now at a letter that I received from the chair of the Gun Violence Prevention Task Force, Congressman Mike Thompson from California, who is the author of that gun bill, which is being dropped today. You know, this is an issue that affects urban communities, rural communities, suburban communities, and it is a priority of mine, not only that we address the public health crisis and epidemic that is gun violence, but that we address the trauma, the residual trauma that gun violence leaves in its wake. And so we're taking a big step today with this bill to push for universal background checks, which will go a long way in keeping guns out of the hands of domestic abusers and the mentally ill. Massachusetts has been leading and has very strong laws, but our neighboring states of Maine and New Hampshire have more lax laws. And so when we see violence in the Massachusetts 7th, more often than not, it is being perpetuated by someone with a handgun that came from New Hampshire or Maine. And so we know that we could save lives if we pass a universal background check. But my advocacy and my work won't end there. I want a permanent ban on assault weapons. I want a gun registry. I want us to close the boyfriend loophole. And I want to see federal investment to support survivors, those families who have been impacted by gun violence. I see that as both violence prevention and intervention to support those families. And I plan on broadening the definition of survivor. I think right now most people define it as a survivor of sexual assault or domestic violence, but we need to more broadly define survivor. And the other thing that I would add is Massachusetts has one of the lowest clearance rates in the country, which is insult to injury, that you are robbed of a loved one due to gun violence and then justice is never served. And I look forward to working on that issue specifically with our new district attorney, Rachel Rollins.
Well, it's an ambitious agenda that we know will keep you very busy, so we appreciate your carving out some time for us in your opening days in Congress. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, thanks very much for joining us on Radio Boston.
All right, thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.